See if we can get that started. Like I said, John chapter number 19. And we're going to be continuing where we left off. And we've been in the middle of Jesus' trial before the religious leaders and the political leaders of the day. And last week, we saw in the last part of chapter 18 that Pilate was going back and forth between the judgment hall and the Jews that were on the outside. They were afraid of contaminating themselves by being both in a judgment hall and being in a Gentile place during the week of the Passover. So as we talked about last week, the Passover was the time at which, the Passover was the time at which looked forward to the Messiah and the Lamb that would take away the sins of the world. And the amazing thing, and we'll see this as we go through this today, the amazing thing is that the Passover almost was a roadmap to the crucifixion of Christ. Everything that happened with Christ's crucifixion was foreshadowed or was pictured in the Passover. And so these religious leaders, these priests and these Pharisees and these Sadducees, they were all carrying out one item at a time, the very same acts of the Passover, only Jesus was the lamb rather than the lamb that they would normally use for the Passover. And they were completely ignorant to it. They couldn't see it. And that's amazing to me. But I mean, the similarities, and I won't go into all of them, but the similarities are unreal. And even down to the day, this was instituted several hundreds of years before this ever happened. This was instituted all the way back whenever the children of Israel came out of Egypt. This was probably, I'd have to look back and count, but it was probably well over 1,000 years between the time that the Passover was instituted and Jesus came on the day of the Passover and was slain as the Passover lamb. And so all of it just completely go, and even the trial that he has multiple times, there's at least 7 trials that he faces where he is observed and they can find no fault in him. And that was part of the Passover, is that they had to separate the lamb, observe it, and make sure it was without spot or blemish. Make sure there was no fault in it before they could offer it up as the Passover. And so he was killed on the day of preparation. And so that was the day that the Passover lamb was killed. And so all of these things, the blood that was shed of the lamb, the blood that was shed of Christ, same thing goes. And so even down to, maybe this might be stretching a little bit, but the fact that at the original Passover, they struck the blood upon the doorpost, the vertical and horizontal post of the door, and Jesus was on the cross, vertical and horizontal. And so anyway, there's many different similarities there, and they were completely oblivious to every one of them.
So Jesus was killed on the day of what?
It was the day of preparation. That was the day that they killed the Passover lamb. And that night, so remember the Jews' time frame went morning to evening.
Yeah, yeah.
Morning and evening was. And so, the evening and morning, excuse me, I said that backward. And so the next day started at sundown. And so it was during the daytime on the day before the Passover, the day of preparation, so take today for instance. Today would be the day of preparation. And then at sundown tonight, which of course in Irish time is good grief in the middle of the night, but anyway, at sundown, it begins the next day. So at sundown today, it would become Monday.
Yeah, because the Jewish day was the
one. Yeah. And so they calculated it backward from what we do, or we do it backwards from what they did. And so anyway, so the day of the Passover started at the evening. And so they would have the Passover lamb in the evening. So basically, they started their day with supper in many ways. So they started in the evening. And so anyway, they would kill the Passover during the day of preparation. Then the next day, starting at evening, would start the Passover. And so that it's to us in our minds, it's all one day. But to them, it's 2 days.
2 days, yeah. Okay, yeah, good.
So you're awake during the transition instead of asleep during the transition, you know?
Yeah.
And so anyway, that's the way that they did things. And so anyway, Jesus was killed on the day of preparation. He was placed into the tomb just before sundown. Okay? Right before the Passover. And so that was the thing. And so he was in the tomb whenever they would be eating the Passover lamb. Okay, so all of these things that happened, and it could be its own study in itself, but I'm not going to do that.
Yeah,
okay,
I know that they saw it's Good Friday and all of this, but yeah. It's like they have it all wrong. The Catholics have the whole place and everything wrong.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, a lot of Christians do too. But yeah, Good Friday and all those, Ash Wednesday, it's all different than what if you go back and actually plan it out, because in order to do it according to like the Good Friday narrative and everything, you would be calculating days differently than what the Jews did, and you would be doing it in a Western mentality rather than, you know, evening and morning. You would be doing morning, evening like we do. And then also, you're not going to have full days, you're going to have partial days.
Exactly. How can you be in the tomb for that amount of time that the Bible stipulates?
So, yeah, as they say, you know what I mean? If they say on Fridays, whenever he died, and they celebrate, and so he would have been put in the tomb just at the very end of Friday, so he would have had just barely a few hours before Saturday at the evening.
Yeah, exactly.
If that, it seems like they were just thrown in there. It wasn't even a few hours. It had been minutes before the next day. So he would have been in there Saturday. Would have been the only day that he had been in there. And would have rose on Sunday. And so he'd only been in the tomb a day and a half.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you don't get 3 days and three nights out of that.
Yeah.
And they try to count part of days and say, well, a part of a day counts as a whole day. When the Bible says specifically 3 days, three nights. It doesn't mean necessarily 24-hour periods, but there's going to be days and nights both. There's going to be most of the day, at least, he's going to be in there.
Yeah.
And so anyway, like I said, we go into an entire study, both with the Passover and also with all the days and all that. But as we looked at this last week, we were talking a lot about Pilate last week. And Pilate, it was very clear from the text that Pilate was performing a balancing act. Okay, I feel sorry for the guy, to be honest with you. People have a lot of hatred for him, and to be honest, he was a pawn. He was. And so I feel sorry for the guy. He was miserable, he was confused, and so through all this, he was just being manipulated and misled by these religious guys. And so he was just, all these pressures upon him, he was trying, and have you ever been in the place where you had so many pressures from so many different directions, and you were just trying to make the right decision and do the best that you can at the time? That's where Pilate was. He had all these pressures from all different directions and he did not know what to do. And he was basically a broken man at this. And as I said, historians tell us that Pilate's end was that he basically went insane and ended up committing suicide. And I believe it was a direct result of all of these things that he suffered. I mean, just the ruling of the Jewish people and the balancing act, all of that would have been enough. But I think it was a direct result of him crucifying Jesus. And the guilt that he had from that. And so anyway, he pronounced Jesus innocent and tried to set him free, but he was unable to do so. And so the last thing that we saw was him offering up somewhat of a last-ditch effort here. He said, okay, you all have a tradition. So the best way he knows to appeal to religious men is through their traditions, right? That's the way it goes. Still to this day, one of the best ways to appeal to them, by their tradition. And so anyway, he appeals to their tradition and he says, okay, you have Barabbas over here, who is a murderer, a thief, and all of these things, or you have Jesus that I can honestly not find anything wrong with him whatsoever, and your tradition is that I release one person at the Passover. And it would go back to their, and this wasn't instituted by God, this was man's idea, this is their tradition, but that the guilty went free at the Passover, okay? The ones who were marked for death received life. They didn't die. There was a substitute made. And so at the Passover, they would release a criminal of some sort. And so he said, here's the thing. We don't have to pardon him or say that he's innocent. We can still claim that he's guilty, but we'll release him so I don't have to punish him. And that's his hope. And so surely if I bring up Barabbas, the murderer of the thieves, this guy that's, you know, mean and arrogant and spitting and slobbering. And you can imagine he come out probably like an animal. They brought him up. You had Jesus standing there, meek, humble, fully controlled, acting in an honorable way. And then you had Barabbas over here acting like an animal. And they're brought in before and they said, okay, which one do you want? They said, we want Barabbas. And he's like, are you stupid? But in reality, they were looking for a Messiah like Barabbas. Because it says that Barabbas led insurrection. And who was his insurrection against? Who was he rebelling against? Rome. And so this was one of the reasons why Pilate was so confused, was because Jesus is, they're claiming that he's leading insurrection against Rome, right? They're saying he's the king. And so if Jesus is claiming to be an insurrectionist, the Jews ought to love him. But he wasn't their kind of insurrectionist. In reality, he was inciting insurrection against false religion, not against Rome. That's what he was doing. That's why they hated him so badly. So anyway, they released Barabbas being what they accused Jesus of being. Jesus was innocent. Barabbas was guilty. And so Barabbas was released as innocent. Jesus was crucified as guilty of doing the very same things that Barabbas was actually guilty for. And so in this, you find the most clear illustration of salvation you will find anywhere. Because Jesus took Barabbas's, not just his punishment, but he also took his accusations upon himself. He became, in the law's eyes, he became guilty of what Barabbas had actually done. And Barabbas became innocent. That's what happens at the moment of salvation with us. Perfect picture. And man could not have made this up. I mean, all these things that we see, and these are documented by secular history, that Jesus was an actual man. He really did exist. He actually made the claims. He was actually killed by Romans at the hand of jealous Jews. All that's documented in secular history. And man couldn't have put it together. And there isn't any sane historian that will deny the existence of Jesus or even his death. Okay? And there are those who will mock the resurrection, but they can't disprove it either, because it is verified in history that these claims actually happened. Whether you believe it or not, the body was missing. They couldn't find it. And at the time, it seems as if those around accepted it. They did. They lied to cover it up, but there was nothing they could say against it. And so anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself in all this, because we're going to be covering the death, burial, and resurrection and all of this. But anyway, you're not going to find, like I said, a clearer illustration of salvation anywhere than Jesus and Barabbas and the substitution that takes place there. And so now as we continue, we're going to find Pilate cowardly trying to straddle the fence. Okay? And as we look here, we'll start reading in verse number 1 of chapter 19. It says, "Then Pilate therefore took Jesus and scourged him, and the soldiers platted a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they put on him a purple robe and said, 'Hail, King of the Jews!' And they smote him with their hands. Pilate therefore went forth again and said unto them, 'Behold, I bring him forth to you, that ye may know that I find no fault in him.'" And now this seems almost ironic or oxymoronic here, maybe I should say, that he says, "I'm punishing him just to let you know that I don't find any fault in him." He's a pawn. He's doing their bidding when he's supposed to be the ruler. It's like parenting today. You know who's actually in control. That's what's going on. And it's like the Jews were the children and Pilate was the parent, but yet, you know, the children are running the house here. This is what's going on. And so he says, "Behold, I bring him forth to you that you may know that I find no fault in him. Then came Jesus forth wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, and Pilate saith unto them, 'Behold the man.' When the chief priests therefore and the officers saw him, they cried out, saying, 'Crucify him, crucify him.' Pilate saith unto them, 'Take ye him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him. Execute him, even though I find no reason to do so.' The Jews answered him, 'We have a law, and by our law he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of God.' When Pilate therefore heard that saying, he was the more afraid. And went again into the judgment hall, and saith unto Jesus, 'Whence art thou?' But Jesus gave him no answer. Then saith Pilate unto him, 'Speakest thou not unto me? Knowest thou not that I have the power to crucify thee and have the power to release thee?' Jesus answered, 'Thou couldest have no power at all against me, except it were given thee from above. Therefore, he that delivered me unto thee hath the greater sin.' And from thenceforth Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, saying, 'If thou let this man go, thou art not Caesar's friend. However, or whoever maketh himself a king speaketh against Caesar.' When Pilate therefore heard that saying, he brought Jesus forth and sat down in the judgment seat in a place that is called the pavement, but in the Hebrew, Gabbatha. And it was the preparation of the Passover and about the sixth hour. And he saith unto the Jews, behold your king. But they cried out, away with him, crucify him. Pilate saith unto them, shall I crucify your king? The chief priests answered, we have no king but Caesar. And so there's a lot that happened in this, and most likely we're not going to get through all of it today. And I don't want to rush it, don't want to hurry through it here. But this is a surreal and amazing and important period of time and an event for all Christians. And oftentimes we glance over it just as a historical fact. We glance over it as, oh yeah, that's a story I've heard all my life. And it loses its power. It loses its effect. But as we're going to be reading through this, I want us to actually be thinking about this, going into our minds and our hearts and realizing this is the Son of God, that he was dying in our place to make the way of salvation for whosoever will. This is what he was doing at this time. He was being treated this way by his creation. You have the creator of all things being abused and murdered by the creation. This is what's going on here. And it's all due to his love for that creation. And I've used the illustration, not to make light or anything, but I've used the illustration many times about how differently we would do things. I use the illustration of the man who questioned God's ability and his reason behind doing things as he was walking through the woods one day. And he said, it makes no sense to me that the mighty oak tree grows from such a small nut, such a small seed. But yet the watermelon plant grows just to be this little old puny looking vine and everything. But look what a huge seed the watermelon is. And he said, if I had been God, I would have made the oak tree grow from the watermelon. And I would have made the watermelon vine grow from the little tiny acorn. He says, that makes sense to me. Small seed, small plant. Big seed, big plant. But as he was walking along through the woods and admiring all of creation and everything, an acorn fell out and hit him in the head. And he said, I'm glad that wasn't a watermelon. Okay? And so that illustration, it shows us, you know, we have a way of thinking about things, but it is so minute. It's so small. We don't realize all the ramifications of everything, how big this really is, but God has made everything perfect. I mean, down to small details, things that scientists are finding every day that God did, and there's purposes behind it. Even parts of the human body, you know, things that have that scientists have said and doctors have said for years, oh, that has no purpose whatsoever. Let's remove it. You know, your appendix, your spleen, your wisdom teeth, things like that. Let's just get rid of them. They have no purpose. They're extra parts. And now they're starting to find out, wait, you may need those. Let's not take those out unless we have to. Yeah, you can function without them, but it's best if you don't. And so those are just minor illustrations of this. Yeah. But we look at this, and I would say, if I was God. Have you ever done that? Have you ever said that? If I was God, I would have done this. The thing is, if you were God and you knew everything that God knows, you would do everything the same way that God does it. Okay? You would have perfect wisdom and perfect knowledge. But I look at this, and I say, if I was God, I would have wiped them all out. Right? I would. That's my way of thinking. If I would be God, okay, if I would have been God, I wouldn't have existed anymore. I would have killed me a long time ago. I would have got tired of putting up with me. Okay? If God was me, basically, you know, that's what would have happened, and along with a lot of other people in the world. But more than likely, the world wouldn't exist because I would say, how ungrateful. I've done everything for them, and yet they despise me and they deny my existence. I just kill them all. I definitely wouldn't have made it through the crucifixion. No way I would have died for them. I don't love them in that way, right? But we see God's love in all of this, that he would be willing to go through all of this punishment and shame and rejection and ridicule and keep his composure throughout all of it, keep his dignity, and go through all the suffering, the pain, everything, and through it all still retain his love. Because even as he was going through this, even as he's dealing with Pilate tenderly. He's leaving a lasting impression on Pilate. And so with all of these things, even the ones who were crucifying him, he still was dealing tenderly with them. The thieves on the cross, both of them, we often lose track of this, both of the thieves on the cross mocked and ridiculed Jesus. But one in the middle of that did an about face and said, wait a minute, we're mocking and ridiculing him. We're all in the same position. We're all getting ready to die, but he's innocent and we're guilty. And so he looks at him and says, there's something different about him. He must be who he says he is. And I'm going to trust him. And he calls upon him and says, remember me when you enter into your kingdom. That's what he does. And so he is saved, even though he started out mocking Jesus. And Jesus immediately, he didn't say, hey, remember what you were saying 5 minutes ago? Boy, you changed your tune. Forget it. Die and go to hell. That's what we would have done. But he says, today you'll be with me in paradise. Right? Roman soldiers, all of them around. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. That's amazing. We lose track of who this Jesus really is. We make him out to be some kind of sissy. That's not the actions of a sissy. It's not. This isn't being some kind of... I'll continue to use the term sissy. This isn't what it is. It's not being some kind of a sissy. Because it takes someone of great character and dignity and mental fortitude to be able to go through all of this and still yet have mercy upon them. It's an amazing thing. And so anyway, going back to chapter 19 here, we're finding Pilate. Sorry, I'm chasing rabbits this morning. But anyway, it's just amazing all these things that we're going through and what Jesus went through here and seeing all of this. The world makes light of it, but this is the most important event that the world has ever had. You know, we celebrate his birth at Christmas time. Oh, this is one of... But the most important event was this here that we're seeing now. It's his death. His birth would have done no good if he didn't come to die. And so anyway, so as we see Pilate here in the first verse, Pilate therefore took Jesus and scourged him. And Pilate knew as he's doing his balancing act, as he's straddling the fence here, that the Jews would not allow Jesus to get off unpunished. Okay? He had offered up Barabbas. And so that would have been a way to let Jesus go with basically a pardon here, saying he was guilty, but we're letting him go anyway. At least he's been condemned. They wouldn't go for that. So, okay, well, we're going to have to do something to punish him. And so we'll punish him. He's an innocent man. We don't want to kill him, but we'll punish him. So they took him out to scourge him. And now the scourge was a whip of multiple cords. And in it had bone fragments and metal and glass and rock and all kinds of things in that cord. Okay. And they said that it would actually be dipped in blood and everything to give it a, like in sheep's blood, to give it a little extra stickiness to where it would grab the skin. And so as they would bring the whip around, it would grab into the skin and they would yank it back off and it would rip and tear the skin. Okay, this is what they would do. Now, many people say that he would have been whipped 39 times, you know, the whole 40 save one, because that 40 was considered a death sentence and they didn't want to go over the 40, and so they would always spare a couple in case they miscounted. The only thing is, that was a Jewish principle. He was scourged by the Romans. They had no such principle. Yeah. So we don't know how many times he was whipped. Doesn't say. We don't know. And so...
Pilate didn't do that himself, did he? He just ordered it.
Yeah, Pilate would have ordered the soldiers to do it. Pilate didn't actually do the scourging. And... So, as it reads there in verse number 1, Pilate therefore took him and scourged him. However, we look at the parallel passages and just the normal way of doing things, Pilate wouldn't have done it. Honestly, with what I see here, Pilate wouldn't have the heart to do it. He just basically, in disgust, says, take him and scourge him then. And so he's trying to appease the Jews, even though he's finding nothing to punish Jesus for, he's punishing a man he knows is innocent. And so... as he decides to have him scourged with no guilt, no accusation, punishing him in spite of him being innocent, I believe the main reason that he did it was the hope that it would appease the Jews and he would get off short of actually having to kill him. Another reason would have been that he may have been doing it to try to find some reason that he could hang on to in order to carry out the Jews' wishes. If we look in Acts chapter 22 and verse number 24, we find Paul as he stands before the Romans, and they the words that are used is that they are going to examine Paul by scourging. Okay? They're going to examine him. So basically, they're going to torture him till he talks. That's the way of whenever they're talking about examining him. And so I believe maybe this was part of what they were doing to Jesus, hoping that either because none of this, the pieces aren't fitting together for Pilate. This doesn't make sense. The ones that need examined are the Jews, not Jesus, because they're the ones that's got the backward motives and all these different things. But anyway, they're hoping maybe he will say something. Maybe he is just a really good con artist, and if they whip him, then the truth will come out. Or if he is telling the truth and he honestly is an innocent man, maybe this will finally break him because he's kept his composure the whole time. And so maybe now he'll lash out in anger and rage and fury, and he will speak against Pilate and against Caesar and against everybody, and then we'll have something to execute him for. This is just my thoughts, my opinion on this. Maybe these are the reasons. I can't say it dogmatically. But anyway.
Or maybe to appease the Jews, just look, we scourged him.
Yeah.
So is that not enough?
That would have been the main reason. Yeah, that would have been the main reason is that, and we see him presenting Jesus to him in just a minute, and hoping that seeing him absolutely beat to a pulp, they'd be, okay, well, we're satisfied now. We don't think he's going to continue this route anymore. Yeah, go ahead and turn him loose, and he can go and lick his wound somewhere. But I believe it could have been both, okay? It could have been both to satisfy the Jews saying he's been punished enough, or finding at least a reason to justify what he's having to do.
I mean, he must be some evil guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? To look at somebody and say, I'm going to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I want to. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's crazy. And so like I said, either of these two here, or both of them together, I believe it was honestly a combination of both, that Pilate is sitting here saying, I've got to do something, I have no idea what to do, and this is a last-ditch effort. Okay, if I scourge him, then maybe they'll let him go, or maybe he will condemn himself. One or the other, but something will happen, and it will make my job easier. And that's what Pilate's desiring here. Either I don't have to kill him or I have reason to kill him, but either way, I need something here. And Jesus still doesn't give him either. And so anyway, if he was hoping that he would confess wrongdoing or say something, I don't know. But anyway about it, Jesus doesn't do that. So the scourging itself would have been brutal. Okay? And as we said, it was ordered by someone who declared him to be innocent. And Pilate knew what the scourging would consist of. And he still ordered it anyway. I mean, this was barbaric. It was brutal. And it was often enough to kill a person, just the scourging itself. And it didn't kill Jesus. And another thing about it is that the scourging had to happen in the crucifixion because it was a fulfillment of prophecy. And little did Pilate know that he was fulfilling prophecy. If you look in Isaiah chapter number 50 and verse number 6, it says, I gave my back to the smiters. And that's talking about Jesus as the Messiah. He gave his back to the smiters. And in Isaiah chapter number 50, it's actually going into some of the things that Jesus suffered at the hands of Pilate and the Roman soldiers there. And so anyway, it had to happen as a fulfillment of prophecy. And all along, not only was Pilate a pawn to the Jews, he was also a pawn to God. He was doing what God had already predetermined through prophecy down through the ages. Because remember, Jesus was the lamb that was slain from the foundation of the world. All these things were foreordained that they would happen. And so in verses number 2 and 3, we see the soldiers and their actions toward Jesus. It says, and the soldiers plaited a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they put on him a purple robe and said, Hail, King of the Jews! And they smote him with their hands. We also find in the other parallel passages that they took a reed as a scepter and smacked him on the head with it and then gave it to him to mock him as if he was a king with a crown, a royal robe, and the scepter. All of it mocking him. And so with the orders to scourge him already, I mean, that was a brutal beating. And so, hey, if his end is going to be this, the soldiers decided, let's have fun with him. This shows you how wicked they were, that this is where they got their jollies. Okay? This is what they enjoyed, is going out and just absolutely... Jesus obviously hadn't done anything against them, right? And they had no reason whatsoever. I mean, if this guy would have harmed me or my family, then by all means, yes, I would have beat him to a pulp. But Jesus had done nothing. Even the way that he carried himself. I mean, I would even, if I was a soldier, I would find it a little bit easier to perform this if this guy was just, if Jesus would have been like Barabbas. You know, if he would have been coming out and cursing and spitting and, you know, fighting and, but Jesus wasn't. Could you imagine as they were leading him to be scourged, they would tie him fast to some kind of a post or something in the middle of the floor. They would stretch him out, stretch the muscles out so that as they were striking him, and Jesus would have embraced it. He would have put his hands forward. He wouldn't have fought against it. He wouldn't have struggled. As they were leading him, they wouldn't even have to keep him tied. They wouldn't even have to keep, he would have followed. And all these things, just submissive to all of this, because this was his hour. This is what he came to do. And he did it all willingly. And so anyway, they took the liberty to mock him and to torture him beyond just the scourging. And as I said already, consider who Jesus is, who was abusing him, and what they subjected him to. And that's the very essence of love. He loved those that hated him. He loved those that abused him. That's amazing. And so to top it all off, he came to this earth knowing this is what was going to happen to him. And he still came. He knew before he ever came to this earth, before he was ever born in Bethlehem, that he was one day going to shed his blood in Pilate's judgment hall. He knew he was going to be beat, mocked, slapped, abused, all of these things. He knew he was going to be crucified. He knew all of it. He did it anyway. And so the Roman soldiers had no love, no sympathy for the Jews whatsoever. They didn't care a thing for them. And the fact that Jesus was meek and was humble and reserved looked like a joke to them whenever he claimed to be the king of the Jews. And the Romans, they were used to power and force and authority. They were used to that. And so as they were looking at Jesus, and the claim was, he's the king of the Jews, and they said, what a pathetic excuse for a king. Because to them, a king came with power, with authority. Not with love, but with wrath. Not with sympathy, but hardened. Okay? And so they looked at Jesus and they said, what a joke, let's beat this guy. And they did. Now's a good time for us to point out some interesting parallels between Adam's fall, which made this all necessary, and Jesus' crucifixion. We already pointed out some of the parallels between the Passover and Jesus' death. But now just some of the things that I noted here, and there's more of them, I'm sure. But some of the parallels between this, and even maybe a few contrasts in here. But the fact that it all started with a tree and ended with a tree. Right? Sin came from Adam's disobedience. Salvation came from Christ's obedience. Adam ate the sweet fruit, but Jesus drank the bitter gall. Remember, it was offered to him, the bitter gall, and also the bitter cup that he prayed, if it be possible, that it pass from me. So man had the sweet, God had the bitter. God covered Adam's nakedness. Remember how he killed the animal and clothed him with the skins? But man made Jesus naked. They took his clothes and cast lots for his vesture. More than likely, he would have hung naked on the cross. So Adam was clothed by God. Jesus was made naked by man. Adam brought a curse upon man, but Christ became a curse for man. And we'll look at that whenever we study Galatians on Wednesday night. The penalty for sin caused sweat on Adam's brow. He says, by the sweat of your brow, you'll earn your meat, right? Earn your bread. But the penalty for sin caused Jesus to sweat blood. As he was in the garden. It says that his sweat became as great drops of blood. Well, the first sweat came with Adam as a penalty for sin. We also find that thorns were the result of sin. Thorns didn't exist in the garden. Whenever God created thorns, it was part of the punishment for Adam's sin. And whenever God created thorns and said that these thorns are going to be pricking your hands and you're going to have to work and fight all these thorns the rest of your life, Adam, and all the future generations and things, He knew whenever he created the thorn that one day he would wear them. And he created them anyway. And so the thorns was a symbol of the curse. But then Jesus wore the thorns as a crown. Adam's sin separated him from God. He had to hide from God. He had to put distance between him and God. And not only that, is that he no longer had that fellowship with God and he was put out of the garden. But whenever man's sin came up on Christ, it separated him from God. And it says that the Father turned his back on him and he cried out from the cross, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Man's sin brought that separation between God the Father and God the Son.
Can you
say that one again? Sorry. Okay. Adam's sin separated him from God. But man's sin caused God to turn his back on Jesus. It separated Jesus from God.
I was still thinking about one thing and I wasn't listening to the she thinks I didn't get it.
Let it sink in for a minute, huh?
You know what I mean?
And then the last thing I'll bring out here, and like I said, there's probably others that I could go into with all this, but Adam was clothed with skins by God. Out of love and mercy upon Adam, Adam stood there naked and ashamed and guilty, and God said, let me clothe you. Okay. However, Jesus was clothed with a robe by man for his mockery and for his shame. So God covered Adam's shame and guilt. However, the Romans and the men made Jesus see shame, not guilt, but shame, whenever they put the royal robe upon him and they spit upon him and they mocked him and all of these things. And so, as you can see, there's several different parallels and contrasts between Adam and Jesus here. But it should never be forgotten or taken for granted the price that salvation cost. And on top of all that, you know, we look at all the physical pain and everything that Jesus went through, because, to be honest with you, through the scourging and everything, the flesh would have been ripped from his body. More than likely, his intestines would have been exposed and his insides would have been exposed. Okay? It says that they smote him with their hands. It's not, they were striking him in the face. His face would have been swelled up. His eyes would have either been swelled shut or maybe even out of socket. Okay? He was beat. He was battered. He was bloodied. The prophecies tell us that he is going to be, I've got it written down, future notes here. I'm getting ahead of myself. But that his visage would be so marred that he wouldn't even be recognizable as a man. Mm-hmm. And so with all of these things, this is what Jesus went through. Okay? He was beaten, he was battered, he was bloodied, he would have been, I don't know how he could have even stood before them anymore with the beating that he suffered. But as great as the physical pain would have been, that wasn't the greatest pain that he suffered, because he was there being rejected by the ones that he loved. And so the pain mentally, emotionally, in his heart would have been greater than the pain of his body, because he is being rejected by those that he loves. All of this, he looks at them not with contempt, but with sympathy, because he loves them. And so as we look here in verse number 4, we continue on. It says, Pilate therefore went out again and saith unto them, behold, I bring him forth to you, that you may know that I find no fault in him. So back to the back and forth here again, right? He's going out like a yo-yo here. He's a pawn back and forth between the Jews and the judgment hall. And like I said, because they didn't want to defile themselves, and that's ironic or stupid one. We don't want to defile ourselves before the Passover, but we're just going to have someone murdered. But we don't want to be in a Jew's house, or a Gentile's house, excuse me. That's dumb, isn't it? It goes back to, okay, we're gonna really do something absolutely horrendous, but we don't want to do something small. It's like, I'm going to go shoot somebody, but I'm going to make sure I'm going to wear my seatbelt on the way there. Right? Don't want to break the law. It's illegal to ride without a seatbelt. Let's go shoot someone. And so in verse number 5, Jesus comes forth so he can be seen of his accusers. It says, then came Jesus forth wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, and Pilate said unto them, behold the man. So he's been struck on his face. He's been having the skin ripped from his body and this flesh, the muscles, everything. Like I said, his insides would have probably been exposed at this time. And he's got the crown of thorns on his head, drove down into his scalp, blood streaming down his face, okay? Beaten and bloody and bruised and battered. Has the robe over his back, and they bring him forth, meek and humble. And Pilate says, "Behold the man." As I said, it was Isaiah 52 and 14, by the way, where it says his visage was so marred, okay? Isaiah 52 and 14. But Pilate presents him, hoping that these bloodthirsty Jews would be satisfied. And I believe as he brings him out, he looks at them, he says, "Behold the man. Look what you've done to him. Is this not enough? Are you not satisfied? Look at him." Hoping that they'll say, "Okay, we're satisfied now. Good enough. Let him go. I think he's learned his lesson." But I find it interesting here that he shouts out, "Behold the man." Because Jesus began his ministry, the first thing as he was coming on the scene was John said, "Behold the Lamb that taketh away the sins of the world." So it started with, "Behold the Lamb," now it's, "Behold the man." And he is the Lamb giving his life at the Passover here. He's a lamb about to be slaughtered, but they only see him as a man. And so Pilate is hoping that they are satisfied. But in verse 6, it says, "When the chief priests, therefore, and the officers saw him," how heartless they were. They saw that he had been beaten and bloodied and battered and all of these things. "And whenever they saw him, they cried, saying, Crucify him, crucify him." And Pilate's reaction, he's probably almost dumbstruck by this, because these are supposed to be, you know, religious people. They're supposed to be good and honorable and holy. And yet they're more brutal than the Romans. "And Pilate saith unto him, Take ye him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him." He looks at them and he says, "Take ye him." Who's he talking to? He's talking to the Jews. He says, "I don't want to be the one to carry this out." But remember, as we've talked, that in these past weeks, that the Romans kept the ability to execute people. It was their job, and they gloried in their ability to execute criminals. But Pilate is saying, "I don't, as a Roman, I don't want to execute this criminal. I would rather relinquish my power and my ability as a Roman to carry out capital punishment upon the accused here. I'd rather relinquish that to the Jews and allow the Jews to have this power than for me to do it myself." This is where Pilate's at. And so he declares no fault at all. This is the third time that Pilate says he's innocent. Herod as well declares him to be innocent. There's four times. Then there's several times that he's examined and they can't find anything even amongst the Jews. There's at least seven times that he's examined and they can find nothing against him. And so this is his attempt to appease and to distance himself. He says, "Take ye him." And so he was willing to give over that power to the Jews to appease them, but to ease himself, distance himself from it. This is what he's doing. And so the problem is that the Jews aren't happy with this. They want Pilate to know, because Pilate keeps saying, "I find no fault in him. I find no fault in him. I find no fault in him." And the Jews keep saying, "He's wicked. He's awful. And he deserves death." And so they don't take it well that he keeps saying there's no fault in them. So in verse number 7, I'll just get into this briefly and then we'll stop and come back to it next week. But it says, "The Jews answered him, We have a law, and by our law he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of God." That law is found in Leviticus chapter 24 and verse 16. And it's talking about blasphemy. If anyone commits blasphemy, they are to die. But here's the thing. They're to be put to death by Jews by stoning, not put to death by Romans by crucifixion. So they're breaking their own law that they're trying to uphold. Because the law not only describes the infraction here, the wrongdoing, but also the punishment for it. And they aren't sticking with the punishment. Blasphemy was supposed to be remedied by stoning, and stoning by the Jewish people. And so we see here that they're going away from that. They're not keeping with the law as strictly as... They're only keeping the law when it suits them. You notice that? And that's something that's been held over time, is that there's a lot of people, they've got all their rules and stuff, but they only keep it whenever it suits them. And so anyway, the Jews make sure that Pilate knows why he deserves death. His repeated statements of I find no fault in him doesn't sway them. It doesn't sit well with them, because they believe that their law is higher than the Roman law, that they are morally superior to Pilate, and him being a Roman and being a Gentile is not going to understand these things. We have a higher law to answer to than you do, Pilate. We are morally superior to you, and you're too dumb to understand these things. And so they had originally told him that the charge was that Jesus claimed to be king. Now it comes out, not that he claimed to be king, but that he claimed to be God. And so as it comes out that he claimed to be God, we find in verse number 8, when Pilate therefore heard that saying, he was the more afraid. See, the thing is that Pilate here, he's been afraid of the Jews. He's been afraid of the Romans. He's afraid of Jesus. Because put yourself in Pilate's position for just a moment. What Pilate is seeing here, this is a man like no man he's ever seen. He's had plenty of men come before him. He's seen plenty of men facing death. He's seen plenty of criminals being executed. And this Jesus is different than anything he'd ever seen. There's a time whenever the Jewish leaders send some of their own guards out to arrest Jesus. And they come back empty-handed and said, never a man spake like this man. Pilate's seeing this very same thing. He's seeing Jesus and he's saying, there is something different about this man. He's also seeing the way that the Jews are handling themselves and the way they're falling over themselves to try to kill this man who is a good man, an innocent man. On top of all those things, as I've said before, Pilate wasn't stupid. He was a ruler of the realm, and he knew what all was going on. And the things that Jesus was doing wasn't kept silent. He knew about Jesus' power. He knew about Lazarus being raised from the dead, no doubt. He'd heard it. He knew about men receiving their sight, lame being able to walk. He knew about the teachings of Jesus and how he would set, and tens of thousands would come to him and hear him teach. And the things that he was teaching wasn't insurrection. It wasn't rise up against Rome. It wasn't all these things that he would expect. He knew all these things. And he said, there's something about him. And as soon as the Jew said, he claims to be the Son of God, fear grips Pilate. He's like, what am I doing? What am I messing with? Something that John doesn't record here, but I believe it's recorded by Luke, one of the others, is that Pilate's wife comes to him. Says, have nothing to do with this just man, because I have suffered many things this day in a dream because of him. And so even that is warning. But on top of that, you've got to remember that the Romans are very superstitious as well. They had multitudes of deities and gods and all these different things. And so it wouldn't be that far-fetched for him to particularly be looking at someone as possibly being the sons of God, being a Roman, because they would be more open to that. And so in this statement, I believe Pilate just got in way over his head. He's already said, take him and crucify him. I find no fault in him. And then they bring out, he says he's the Son of God. And so Pilate is afraid. And so he's got to make a decision in his fear. And we're going to stop there. We'll come back next week and see what all happens here. But Pilate, even though he's already handed down the order to go take him and crucify him, at this time, as soon as he hears this, he says, wait, and he takes Jesus back into questioning further. Like I said, I feel sorry for Pilate. He was in a bad place, and he made a bad decision. But we'll be looking at the rest of that next week. Does anyone have any questions or comments to go along with us today? If there's no questions or comments, let's go ahead and we'll be dismissed in prayer and take a break and wait for everybody else to show up. Dear Lord, we come to you today. Thank you for your blessings. Lord, we do thank you for this opportunity in your word. We thank you and praise you, Lord, for what you endured for us, Lord, that we know we fail you so often, Lord, but I can't imagine all the things that you went through just because you love me. I thank you, Lord, that you bled and died for me, that you suffered all those things so I can have an eternal home in heaven with you, Lord. I pray, Lord, help me to live for you today. And Lord, I just pray you be with our time together, be with the next service that comes, Lord. I pray be with those who are still on their way out. Lord, we do love you. We thank you. And we praise you for all you do for us. And all these things I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
I'll take photo of your notes.